Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. It is very difficult sometimes to listen to the stories of people, what they have survived. I've had the privilege, through my many years of broadcasting, of listening to many stories of people who have survived horrific circumstances and conditions, often beyond what most of us can even imagine. With our conversation today, my guest is going to be Richard Schoen. We are going to be discussing his mother's memoir. Now, the reason that we're talking about this is because around the world globally, we are hearing stories about wars, not just in the Ukraine, but in the Sudan, in so many other places of the world, and including the discord that is occurring in the United States. We don't realize how important peace is. But sometimes we have to be able to really listen to the stories of other people. And we are going to be hearing the story of a woman who survived the Cultural Revolution, born in 1939, the year of the flood, the horrible flood that killed millions of people in China. She was just a babe in arms. I want to welcome to the program her son, Richard Schoen. And Richard, when I was reading your material, you've got three books here. You have volume 1, 2, and 3. Each volume covers a segment of your mother's life. And she lived to be 84, I believe. And I believe she died in 2014. It took you 10 years to put together all of her writings. It is an incredible story that I think some people would find very hard to believe. Welcome to Warriors for Peace.
Donna, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be back on your show.
When you found your mother's documents, I would like for you to go and tell my audience a little bit about what she had written, and also about what happened to her when she was just a babe in arms. She was given the Chinese name of Spring Flower, and she was born into a farmer's family in a horrific year that killed millions of people, the floods that occurred from what is known as the Yellow River, the Yangtze River. Would you share her story for that part of her life, please?
Yes. My apologies for maybe making some corrections. She was born 1931.
Oh, 31. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Donna, it's okay. So Yangtze River flood was ranked as one of the deadliest natural disasters in the 20th century. Killed upwards about 4 million people from drowning, post-flood starvations and pandemics, and infectious diseases, I guess. And so from that standpoint, she was lucky to be alive. And not only that, her biological parents obviously couldn't afford raising her because they were dirt-poor farmers at the time. And so they somehow stumbled into my American grandparents across the river, actually, and asked my American grandmother to consider adopting my mother. And so, my American parents adopted her when she was about 10, 11 months old. That would still be 1931 or early parts of 1932. And so began the story, I guess, began her life. Yeah.
At that time in Chinese history, and again, feel free to correct me if I'm not remembering it rightly, baby girls were sold. Her biological family, there were already other siblings, but boy babies were valued more than the girl babies. And she was trying to arrange, before the missionaries adopted her, the biological mother was trying to arrange a marriage between her daughter and another family so that the girl would have a chance to survive. This was a practice that had gone on for many generations in China, had it not?
Yeah, for centuries. For centuries, maybe even today, somehow baby boys are totally overvalued, right, for irrational reasons, simply because they could carry on the family name. That's one of them. But by the early 20th century, China had begun to treat women and girls slightly better, and I will give that credit to Western or American missionaries. Missionaries indeed raised the awareness of human rights, particularly women's rights. But the gender discriminatory practices continued in rural farming, fishing villages. And so, the odds were totally stacked against my mother, not just the flood, but she was a baby girl. And at that time, what they would do is they will either leave the baby girls on the roadside to die or until somebody picked them up, or they will marry them off to a family and to become a future servant, slave, and a pseudo-daughter-in-law to continue to bring forth more baby boys. And so my mother's biological parents were considering all those options, and lucky for my mother, they weren't. The first option wasn't leaving her on the sidewalk to die. They were trying to give her away. And then writing this memoir made me realize that the flood was a blessing in disguise in some ways. Of course, it killed millions of people, but because most people at that time were in trouble in terms of survival. So nobody wanted another mouth to feed, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mother's biological parents couldn't give her away. And then in the process of looking for milk and food, they heard about these refugee camps set up by American missionaries across the river. And so they went across the river, and that's where, in seeking milk and food for my mother, they found these American medical missionaries who were willing to take my mother in.
Dr. and Mrs. Edward C. Perkins. Dr. Perkins had a passion for working with the Chinese people. He established the first male hospital. Now, that was sort of a surprise to me. I thought, gee whiz, why wasn't a general? But he did have something of a general hospital, but the medical care for men and women was horrific in China when they were there in the 30s. But he had made, along with his wife, just tremendous inroads. And they were very strong believers in education, and they had adopted a number of girls. And, of course, your mother was a baby, but she grew up in that environment, and then they were forced to leave China, and she was fortunate enough to be able to come to America for a short period of time before going back to China. The story of the missionaries, and especially of Dr. and Mrs. Perkins, is a very powerful one. Give us a little bit of background on that.
Yes. Let's see. My American grandfather, so Dr. Perkins, was born and raised in Hartford, Connecticut, wealthy banker's family. Their neighbors were Samuel L. Clement, pen name for American name, Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the house was Harriet Beecher Stowe. So he grew up a silver spoon. And then by the time he finished his college and medical school, he began to search for meaning of life. And he found becoming a missionary, go to essentially a third world country, would serve that purpose. And so in 1916, he married my American grandmother. My American grandmother was a Scottish immigrant, born and raised in Edinburgh, before moving to Yonkers, New York, because her father was an architect in New York City. And so in 1916, after they got married, they had this one-way ticket on a trans-Pacific ocean liner for their honeymoon, and landed in China. And then in 1918, they together established this new hospital in the town that ultimately they adopted my mother some 13 years later. Actually, right or wrong, when they were adopting my mother, they used their own money and built a brand new building to host the hospital that had been a rented facility. And so they had a lot of help from other missionaries, the British missionaries and American missionaries, particularly two from Grand Rapids, Michigan, second-generation Dutch migrants. And so they were nurses working my grandparents' hospital. And together, they trained hundreds of Chinese physicians and nurses, and they saved thousands of lives. Most of those Chinese people were from dire poverty. And so I think in just 30, 40 years, they've done some extraordinary things for China, for Chinese people.
Because of them coming back, and they were forced out of China, what were the circumstances that forced your grandparents out of China to bring your mother to America for a short period of time?
Yes. So 1937, Imperial Japan decided they've already occupied the northeast territory of China, and they decided that wasn't enough. So they had a vaunted military. So they swept through the entire China, including southern part of China and ultimately Southeast Asia. And so once that took place, because America and England were not at war, so as long as you erect American flag or British flag and paint a red cross on top of your roof, Japanese bombers will not bomb you, and then Japanese soldiers or military will not bother you. So actually, my American grandparents and my mother and the whole hospital remained open. They stayed for a while until 1941, December 7th, 1941. I might have gotten that date wrong. Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when America declared war with Japan. And then so suddenly all the American personnel had to leave China, leave all the countries that were being occupied by Japan.
How were they able to get your mother out,
yes,
though?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
How were they able to get your mother out? Because she was Chinese.
Yes, so amazingly, they so like what you had alluded to earlier, my American grandmother was very high on educating women, young girls. Right? So she had adopted many young girls before my mother, and those are all pretty much teenagers or maybe already in their 20s. She supported them to go to school and college and so on. But none of them were... Donald was officially adopted until my mother was officially adopted in the U.S. Supreme Court of China in Shanghai. And so that there was official documentation or official court paper supporting her adoption. So they were able to get exiting paperwork, paper to get her out of China with them. And so she became... one of the two, I believe, Chinese national underwent this so-called POW exchange, which was part of American history that was very little known and very little talked about until maybe in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
much later. And so she was being a part. She was part of this exchange with thousands of Americans gathered from China, Japan, Southeast Asia, and exchanged with so-called Japanese prisoners. And the location of exchange was Lorenzo Marques, Mozambique, a Portugal colony at the time. And that exchange took place in 1942, summer of 1942. So from there, from that point on, my mother, right, sailed smoothly to New York Harbor with her parents.
When she arrived, there obviously was an adjustment, but she was young. She was young, and she was able to go to school for a while, and she absolutely loved being in America, and she was totally, totally devoted to her parents. And interestingly enough, there was still a communication with her biological family that was possible, but Dr. Perkins was determined to go back to China. He absolutely wanted to go back to China. But your mom had to come back to China, not because she really wanted to, but that was something that involved a whole series of circumstances. And how old was she when she had to go back to China, and why?
So she would have been 14, and they left New York on a U.S. battleship on their way to Africa, actually. And so it will be right around right around VE Day, or if not on VE Day, so May 1945. And so she was 11 when she arrived in New York, leaving New York when she was 14. And you were right that this was pretty much against her will. She had totally fallen in love with America. And to be fair, she was surrounded by Westerners and English-speaking people since she was 10 or 11 months old, right? And then coming to America and going in, attending elementary school and junior high, pretty much affirmed or solidified her identity as American. And her first language would be English, or if not native language, would be English. She really wanted to stay in America to finish high school and potentially also go to college. But like what you said, my American grandparents were completely devoted to their mission in life is to help Chinese people to be in China and to devote to their medical mission and Christian mission. And so they didn't really ask what she wanted. They just took her with them. Yeah. They then spent about a year in India because Pacific War was still ongoing. And so by the time my mother truly returned to China, it would be 1946, she was 15 years old.
What were the circumstances that caused her to go back to China?
Circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
I guess for her, ultimately, she figured wherever her parents will be, her American parents will be, that's where home is. And so she, despite reluctance of leaving New York, leaving America, she wanted to be with her family, with her parents. And she was very close to her mother.
So,
and by the time she returned to China, she couldn't speak much Chinese at all. And she was very poor in all of that to begin with. And she had to attend high school. Lucky for her that the high school was bilingual, English speaking anyway, so that helped a little bit and then allowed her to actually ultimately enroll in college a few years later.
Now with the go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, between 1946 and 1949, then the Civil War broke out between the Communist Army and then the military from the National Republic, Republican Nationalist, the government at the time, the Chinese government at the time. And so those were 3 years of civil war before communists took over in 1949.
So when all of this was going on, your mother was doing an adaptation, but her parents, Dr. and Mrs. Perkins, they weren't allowed to stay in China, were they?
Yes, that was also amazing. The minute after the Communist Army took over her town, they allowed the hospital to remain open and functional, and they realized my grandfather was a skilled surgeon, so they also desperately needed a skilled physician. And so they allowed him to continue conducting hospital business as usual until about a year later, a Korean conflict broke out, and that was pretty much a proxy war between America and China,
mm-hmm.
the Korean Peninsula. And that's when my American grandparents had to flee for the second time.
So here we have this scene, this scenario of your mother not leaving China, but staying in China. Now, for a while, she was able to communicate with her family, but eventually, because of the red effect, the communist effect, when Mao came into power, it changed everything so very, very quickly. Now, in the first volume, you go through those years, and we've just barely touched on it, and there's so much more that occurred. But here we now have the situation where your mother is in school and she's going through all kinds of educational levels to become a doctor. And she ends up staying in China, and then she's met your dad. But this was a very long courtship that went on for quite a while before they ended up getting married. But what she experiences in her training, she really was very fortunate with a lot of the people that she was educated with, and those that were superior to her, what they taught her. And she ended up being a very, very significant specialist when it came to the eyes. Your mother really had to work quite hard. She was sort of derogatory towards herself in her writings about she didn't feel like she was all that smart. And she was homesick, but they were able to communicate for a while. And the letters between them, they were eventually found by you. And they are very powerful expressions. People wrote letters then. They didn't have email with short sentences. These were letters of information and sharing details, and it was very tough for her because she was a woman that was actually torn between two different cultures in two different worlds, wasn't she?
Completely, yeah. Where would I even begin? I think after a while, after a year or two, my American grandparents had left China, she recognized she had to have a different plan. Korean War might not end very quickly, and she might be separated for a much longer period of time from her parents. And she had to learn new ways of surviving. And there were some communications between her and her American parents. But according to my mother, at least when she was talking to me back in the 1980s, that she found about a third of letters to and from, implying that maybe they're about half or two-thirds were confiscated or lost in the mail, period. From those letters, too, you could tell she was extremely close to her mother. So that separation was very traumatic for her. When her parents fled the town and actually went to Canton and then got into Hong Kong and went from there to back to the States, she was a freshman at an English-speaking college about 300 miles away. And so there was no way she could have made it back to leave with her parents. And even if she could have, there wasn't any time to process any, again, paperwork. exit permit to leave the country. So she was completely left alone, left behind. And she was only 19 years old. And it's funny, I always thought that 19 should be old enough. Until I look back on when I was 19, I realized actually 19 is at an age where, A, you're still very young. B, you seem to know everything in about the world. But actually, you don't really know much at all. And so that was pretty much the important transitional point in her life. Yes. And she was, again, like what you said, very fortunate. She was allowed to complete college. At the time, China really wanted to have two groups of professionals. They wanted to train teachers fast, and they also want to train physicians fast because they need both. So both are in a very short in terms of supply. And so my mother was fortunate enough to be shoveled into a profession, essentially medical training profession, and ultimately became an ophthalmologist.
Yes, and she was extraordinarily skilled. Your second book goes into the period of 1951 to 1970. And in the 1951 beginning, that cycle was the beginning of a hell of hells for the Chinese people. And she was totally cut off from anything relating to America. And there was no money that was coming in to her because there was a college that actually had been sending her money so she could survive. She said she was becoming destitute. And at, you know, that age, I mean, she was still very young. That in the best of circumstances. I mean, we have people going through that right now and have been going through that since before even COVID. So when you have that happen to you, that's terrifying because you wonder, what am I going to do? And changes were happening very, very quickly in China, weren't they?
Right. I think the word is terrified. And I think that's where I would give her some credit because she was brave enough. I mean, it was Korean War, right? I'm anti-West. For anti-West sentiment was already at all-time high, even before the war. And by the time the Korean conflict has reached apex, she really was afraid for her life because of her American background and religious background. And so she had to be pretty courageous and brave. And then, of course, along the way, again, fortunate, right? Luck that the Chinese government, the communist government, was wise enough to waive the tuition for these college kids and provide a little bit of stipend. She was probably already a sophomore, junior, or senior, well on her way to finish her medical training. And they also shortened the training, not a 4-year college and a 4-year medical school, and they just shortened it to 5 years. And so all of that working into her favor, and she was able to partly pull herself up by her bootstraps to live through those initial years after communists had taken over.
Mao's program took over China with a rapidness that was unparalleled. And she's very clear because she lived through it. She said that the new government was obsessed with conformity and it was coerced uniformity. And she said it effectively secured and propagated power. And she said it began in September 1951 as one of the largest systematic ideological reforms, in her view, brainwashing in human history. And it merged with 3 anti and 5 anti campaigns and so much more. And under their banner, they had said it was against corruption, anti-extravagance, anti-bureaucracy, anti-bribery, anti-theft of state property, anti-this, that, the other. And in reading her experiences and what she went through, what the people in the hospital went through, and how, you know, she eventually marries Paul, and they are a phenomenal couple, because Paul is, your dad was absolutely brilliant, and he was caught up in a lot of the ideological propaganda until he finally saw what was going on, and he was aware of it even more quickly than your mother was, wasn't he?
Yes, I found that part of their stories or their life quite fascinating, because I think out of fear, my mother kept a low profile to survive, right, and to focus on her medical profession and training and profession and so on. Instead, it was my father who was extremely outspoken, and I learned in later years too that he was indeed always, he had always been this way, very outspoken. When he sensed something is terribly wrong, he would just say it, and he would be very good at justifying what he was saying, much better than I can do. And so my mother was actually afraid for his life because he was so outspoken.
Yes.
He was, to the point he was criticizing some of the economic policies and developmental plans and the communism government had for rebuilding the nation. This will be shortly after the Korean War ended. China was pretty much decimated in every way, economically, especially. So they had all these really ill-advised, ill-thought-of economic policies and plans, or agriculture plans. My father was an agronomist, a professor of agriculture. And so he was very outspoken about those, those ideas of being not well thought of and before being implemented. Not only implemented, but implemented nationwide.
Your father was an amazing man. What she gives and what she recalls is, it's so American. That's all I can say. And it's without going into a long discourse about his logic, his understanding, and his willingness to work with different people no matter where they came from, his willingness to work with scientists. He was deeply involved in genetics. There was so much. And he loved your mother dearly, absolutely pursued her for the longest time. And she, you know, when they got married, it really was a good balance because they complemented each other in many, many ways, but they had no idea of the tragedies that they were going to be experiencing. But your father survived, just like your mother survived, against insurmountable odds. And what I found so interesting is that people that were eye doctors in China at the time were not respected very much. They weren't respected at all. It is fascinating to me the biases that can occur within cultures. And she, though, was very open to learning, and she was one of those people that they said had a rare talent. She had very steady hands. She could do the finest of surgeries, and her hands never shook. They were strong, stable, and they would be standing for hours sometimes doing surgery. And this was a gift. She had no idea that this is something that she had naturally, but it was discovered when she was in medical school, wasn't it?
Yes, that was a saving grace, right? She didn't know that she was going to be good at becoming a surgeon, let alone a surgeon on people's eyes, right? That's a tiny little ball, And these needles are so small, and the threads are so small, so thin. She really had to, a person who's doing that really need to have a very, very steady pair of hands. And one of her, mentors discovered that she wouldn't, you know, she will, she can, she could hold her hands for a very long time, minutes or hours during an operation, and that turned out to be what made her highly acclaimed later on years in China.
Your book, Spring Flower, again, is in three volumes. We're talking about the second one. In the second volume, your mother goes into so much detail about the different systems that were implemented. And please correct me if I'm not pronouncing this correctly. Shushi? A Shushi system? S-H-U-C-H-I system? And that was totally unique, but it literally took over every aspect of the Chinese culture on a personal level and on a professional level. This is something that you said the Western mind would have a difficult time understanding.
Yes, it's a unique moment in history.
With the system, your mother said it evolved into a counterproductive, if not a destructive, system of governance whose sole purpose was to ensure that everyone is vetted in terms of communist ideals. And bureaucracy grew exponentially. It led to increased corruption, decreased transparency and efficiency. And there were all of these subcategories, I'll use that word, of positionings that, my goodness, it so resembled, in my mind's view, what it was done under the emperors. You had this bureaucracy, that bureaucracy, the other bureaucracy, and you had all of these people that had their little fiefdoms. And it was horrific. It totally turned the nation into what I would describe as a torturous prison system. And I knew some people that survived the Cultural Revolution as children. And I remember one young woman that I talked to many years ago, her parents, one was a teacher, the other was the engineer, they were sent out to work in fields. And she was just abandoned, left in a village all by herself. And I think she was 6 or 7 years old. She managed to survive because of the kindness of some people. But this was very commonplace in China. The whole intellectual community on all levels was almost totally devastated, or decimated, I should say. That's the right word. Let's go into that bit of history, because your mother experienced quite a bit.
Yeah. So I think, as you were saying a little bit earlier, that they were, even though 1950s and early parts of 1960s were difficult, but to most Chinese people, or to people like my father, like my mother, still manageable. Until, of course, 1966, the proletarian cultural revolution. I would say that's one of the most singular moments in modern Chinese history, I guess. It was a political purge at the highest level, ultimately degenerated into, I don't want to misuse the word genocide, if I'm allowed to expand its usage. It became a movement targeting highly educated professionals and creative people for various different reasons. We can go into that too. But at the end of this entire movement, which lasted about a decade, this revolution from 1966 to 1976, actually every layer of social fabric or every social economic class, including those so-called have-nots or proletarians, they all underwent some forms of cleansing or reform or re-education. And so to a lot of Chinese people, at the end of this revolution, it was no longer targeting against a certain group of people, but it felt more like extermination.
Mm-hmm.
And then when China came around, everybody looked like a zombie, essentially. A mm-hmm. zombie nation is what my mother would call it.
There was not just the extermination project. that was going on. There was the Red Book, and she describes what it was like being in the hospital, and they had hundreds of patients that were coming into the hospital. And we're just talking about the Chinese people. We're not talking about an invasion by any other country. We're not talking about anything else. We are talking about a group, a very small group of people, that ended up taking over the entire country and literally making them into slaves, and people were dying by the millions. And the economy of China went downhill so fast. It was a total disaster. The black market, if you had any means of money, money had no value in the general culture, but it did on the black market. And this was terrifying. And people turned against each other. They just didn't know what to do. But at the same time, there's tremendous stories that your mother shares in this book of the kindness of people and what they went through and how they were able to survive. And she was separated from your father for years, even after they were married. And then eventually your father, who is known for his brilliance relative to farming and to genetic research, but he had written some things that were used against him. And he had to go out and work in farmers' fields, but somehow or another, he managed to survive. Tens of millions of people died.
Yep. Tens of millions of people died or went to labor camps and prison. Most of them are, again, highly educated professionals and creative people, creative forces. And my father was one of the earlier batches sent to a labor camp, I guess Stalinist gulag.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he spent about 4 or 5 years there. I had to consult my older sister exactly how many years, and she had even longer number of years. And I thought that might not be right, but it doesn't really matter. He was there for a long time, to the point where when he came back, I didn't know who he was.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen him before. Remember.
Mm-hmm.
At all. So my mother was essentially raising my sister and I, sister and me alone. She was at the top of the persecution list because she had American background, a religious background. And so she was constantly whisked away to various different reform or rustication programs. Many of them will be far away in some rural countryside, and she will have to spend months or half a year there. And so I try to do my best to help her out, to help my mother out. But I hate to tell you, I wasn't a hero during those chaotic years. We were very fortunate to have some very kind-hearted neighbors, maybe angels in disguise, living next door to us, living in the same compound, I call it a ghetto, and my mom called it a slum.
Mm-hmm.
Because about 20 some families living in essentially a space amounted to be maybe one big house. And so they reached out, and these are factory workers, and they're regarded as the proletarians, or have-nots, right? So they essentially crossed the ideological line, or party line, reaching across the aisle, risking their lives sometimes to help out my mother, to help my sister and me, saving us many times during those years.
And
so because of them, I lived.
Mm-hmm. Very true. One of the points I wanted to bring out is that your sister, shortly after she was born, that it was discovered that she had a disease. And it was cerebral palsy. And it was something that really created a dynamic in your mother's life, because there was a Japanese student that eventually ended up becoming a very, very good friend. And because of his uncle, or information he would pass along to your mother to help your sister learn how to walk, which was considered impossible, and the journey that your mother went through. But in her notes, in the things that she wrote out, I was consistently amazed at the detail. She talks about a generation of young people that were manipulated, that became very abusive. They were killing people. They were beating people. They were the Red Guards. These had been young people that had been totally indoctrinated with the Marxism and the communist demeanor, and there was no conscience in whatever they did. They were gangs, if you will, and they were deadly. And it was all of these various circumstances that she has in her letters and her notes that you are able to bring together in this book. And your books are loaded with photographs, which are especially significant, and all of the difficulties, the paralysis that occurred economically and otherwise within a nation of people that were very hardworking people, and the tragedies that were endured by millions. And sometimes, because she was so intelligent and because she had had exposure in the American environment, I think that contributed a lot to her being naive about many things. But at the same time, it tore at her because it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense that China, her native country, went into such a disastrous patterning. Now, book number 3 covers the years 1970 to 2014. It goes into a lot of detail about your father and about so much of what evolved. It just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And your mother ends up getting pregnant for a third time. Your sister, Gina, was the first child. You were child number 2. But she ended up having an abortion because her husband said, "We're barely surviving as it is. We cannot bring another child into the world." This presents such significant, the series of books, Spring Flower, about what your mother had to go through and what she had to experience because of circumstances that were totally out of her control. Totally out of her control. Richard, when you were bringing all of this together, and there is so much in the material that we're just barely able to scratch the surface of, and your mother ends up having a heart attack, and I feel that it was totally brought on by the stress and the hunger and all of the things that she had gone through and what was going on. And then in 1972, in your third book, you talk about Richard Nixon, President Richard Nixon, making the first trip to China. People didn't even know that he was there, excepting there was one lone newspaper that your father happened to come across. He was working in a library, and what was done to him there was awful. But he was reading all kinds of stuff whenever he could because it kept him from going insane. And he came across this newspaper and this article about President Nixon opening up the venue of communication with China in 1972. That was a huge turning point for your dad, wasn't it?
That was monumental, to the point where I should tell you, or I can tell the audience, that I'm actually named after Richard Nixon. That's where the name came from.
Mm-hmm.
My mother wanted to honor Richard Nixon for reopening and the dialogue between China and America, and for ultimately leading to diplomatic relationship, renewal of diplomatic relationship, and for her allowing her to return to America, which she called home.
When did your mom come into America? What year?
So we officially, the book ended about 1980, but somewhere between 1980 and 81, but officially 1981, early parts of 1981, my mother and I landed in JFK. I was 14 years old.
And your dad and your sister Gina were left in China?
Yes. My sister did not immigrate to the U.S. until 2003 or 4. My father came out a little bit earlier in late 1990s. He decided to just simply retire early, abandon his career, and came to America to live with my mother.
And how did that affect him? Because they had been separated again for years. This had occurred throughout their entire marriage.
Yeah, I try to calculate. I think throughout their entire marriage, they probably were already together for about 10 years, really, or 10, 15 years. And I'm excluding the last 15 or 10, 15 years of my mother's life when she was battling dementia.
Mm-hmm. She wrote all this out before the dementia started coming in.
Right. I think, I wrote a few essays, or somebody asked me to write a few essays recently about what it was like for my mother to write this memoir. So my mother stopped writing her memoir in early 1990s. She began the process about 1981 or 82. So about 12 years or so, and then she stopped about 93, and then only when I was working on her memoir, I inherited all the boxes filled with thousands of pages of her manuscripts and notes and so on, and I found out that she was actually deeply depressed in the early 1990s, and she stopped writing, and then that depression, she might have survived somewhat, but that depression was one of the causes of her early dementia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she went through a lot of difficulties even after coming to the United States. Now, your mother was so incredibly accomplished, as was your father. And you told me that your father didn't survive very long after your mother died. The bond between them was incredibly strong. Incredibly strong. But she just was amazing. I mean, your mother worked professionally in China, saving the eyesight of hundreds, if not thousands, of people while she was there. But she also worked in the late 70s as a professional translator. She translated for the Communist Party's chairman and premier. She was known, as we mentioned a moment ago, known for her skills in surgery. She was avid about research. Your father was a man that was just so highly respected. And I like to think that before he passed away, that he recognized that what he had contributed in the research that he had done, genetic research, agriculturally, et cetera, that he did have a tremendous value. He affected the lives of many people he would never even see because of the knowledge he passed on. Richard, what was this like for you when you were writing about not just your mom, but you were writing about the Chinese people? A horrific time in their history where they went into, as your mother liked to describe, the dark ages. When you were going through this as a mature man and with what you experienced as a little boy during these very, very difficult times of the Cultural Revolution, what were your feelings when that was all done?
It was overwhelming. And it was also, just like for my mother, dredging up her past led to her depression. It was extremely difficult for me to read what she had written about my childhood, about us, about that period of time, a period of engrossing humanity in modern Chinese history. And also it was hard for me to read online and research more stories. I made many trips to China. I interviewed dozens of people just to get more information, things I might not have understood, even though I might have witnessed when I was a kid. And there were so many gaps that my mother had left behind in her writing. And so it was very difficult to absorb all of that, even though it was spread out over a period of 9-10 years. And so, yeah, overwhelming. But yet, I think at the end of the process, I noticed what my mother was trying to do, and I was full, wholeheartedly in support of her her focus or theme, was to accentuate people, wonderful human beings, that allowed my mother to survive, allow my father to survive, allow people like my sister and I to live through the atrocity. And so so she and I both try our best to let these histories, historical moments, just percolate in the background, and then focusing on people. We call them angels, who, again, brave souls who would risk their lives to do things they thought were right. Kind of like this Russian Soviet Union political dissident, Nobel laureate, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, I'm paraphrasing him now, even when brutality reigns supreme, let it not be through me. So I think we try to honor these people using this memoir and remembering them.
Mm-hmm.
Using this memoir. Right.
This is a powerful read, and it is a demonstration of how important it is that for peace to reign in a country, there have to be leaders that are going to have integrity and understand the bigger picture and how it affects millions of lives. This is a very, very definitive reality that your mother shares in the book that you put together, the three books you put together, Spring Flower, Torn When Shifting Worlds, Facing the Red Storm, and so much more. And Richard Chung, I'm so glad we've had a chance to have this conversation. Now, there is a website, and it's called Yangtze River by Hudson Bay dot site, S-I-T-E. Again, that's the Yangtze River, and Yangtze is pronounced, spelled Yangtze River by Hudson Bay dot site. I want to thank you for being my guest. I think you have a legacy here that I hope people will be open to understanding that it represents, sadly, a historical patterning that has happened throughout human history, and we need to be made aware of the red flags that can be flown. And I'm not referring to the Communist Party. I'm referring to danger flags that we need to be aware of so that we don't fall into that kind of a quagmire of ignorance, fear, and superstition that, sadly, we have had to go through too many times in human history. Thank you, Richard, for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna, for having me.
Before I say goodbye, I want to share the dedication that Richard has given in his trilogy, Spring Flower. We dedicate this book to all missionary workers of every race and nation who have helped China in the fields of education and health, and to all those souls in every era and place who managed to preserve the most basic human kindness and decency, regardless of their allegiances, beliefs, and convictions, and in spite of their own need, who survived despite struggling against oppression. These brave men and women are exemplars of a basic wish. To paraphrase Alexander Solzhenitsyn, even when brutality reigns supreme, let it not be through me. This is Donna Sebo. Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour.
Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.